It's like our special guest today, we just keep on playing as we tee off U.S. Open month here on Musings on Golf. Kelly Elbin welcoming you back to another episode of our storytelling-based podcast. And along with the Dean, Jenna Self, our executive producer, we know never to overlook time PGA Tour winner Fred Funk, who you will hear from shortly. I have to tell you, Fred and I conducted what I think is a riveting interview yesterday, and I choose that word because, quite honestly, the story of Fred Funk is truly compelling. And in my opinion, his is one of the truly standout stories in golf, and it's a long story. As Fred last year, talk about continuing to play, he became the 25th player in tour history to play in 1,000 official events, including, of course, the PGA Tour Champions, where he won 9 times. Fred didn't win until his fourth year on tour. And when I was watching Eric Cole in the final round of the Charles Schwab Challenge on Sunday, a lot of Fred Funk kind of came back to me with one missing link, unfortunately. It's Eric Cole's fourth year on the PGA Tour. And man, it looked so much that he was going to get his first win. And he played well after making double bogey on 9. The comparisons are quite striking, really. You know, like Fred Funk, Eric Cole finally made his way to the PGA Tour in his 30s. Battler, scrapper, good golf swing, and just works hard. You can see it. And he played that back 9 in a real solid way. And then all of a sudden, that first win seemingly in his grasp, along comes this birdie barrage by Russell Henley. And it just upended his dream. And as Fred and I talk about, it's a case where Eric Cole didn't lose it. Russell Henley won it. Kind of reminds me a little bit of Cameron Young and him not winning for quite some time, but not because he played poorly, but because somebody else played a little bit better. And that was the case with Russell Henley, who won for the 6th time on the PGA Tour with that sudden death victory, birdieing the last 3 holes in regulation, and then the 18th hole, the first hole in sudden death, to beat Eric. Okay, so here's what Russell Henley had to say afterward about what he feels is the key to playing well at Colonial Country Club and why the win on Sunday is so special for him.
It's just different this week. A lot of the courses we play, you can really get away with hitting it in the rough and hitting it a long way. And clearly I don't hit it a long way, but for this course, you have to be in the fairway to attack. You have to control your irons. You have to shape the ball. It really tests every part of your game and asks you to be fully committed and fully clear on what you're doing. And the wind can be very tricky. So with the history of the tournament, it's so cool to know that I've won it. It's so special for so many reasons.
And it's special for anyone who puts on that plaid jacket, which is the one of many gifts that is given to the winner of the Charles Schwab Challenge. It's Ben Hogan's Golf Club. There's so much history there. Congratulations to Russell Henley. He and Eric Cole will be in the field this week at the 50th Memorial Tournament, Jack's grand event in Dublin, Ohio, outside of Columbus. It's a busy week at the top level of golf, in addition to Jack's event. Before I get to the other 2 tournaments, remember who won the very first Memorial Tournament? It wasn't Jack. Jack won the 2nd Memorial Tournament. It was a guy who we got to know walking the fairways and calling the action much later in his career, and Roger Maltby, he of the Michelob golf bag. That should bring back some memories. He actually beat Hale Irwin in a playoff to win the very first Memorial Tournament in 1976. Raj will not be there this week, as far as I know, but the Memorial Tournament, one of the signature events on the PGA Tour, a great field featuring Rory McIlroy and Scottie Scheffler, should be another fabulous Memorial Tournament as Jack celebrates the 50th anniversary of his terrific event. Congratulations to Preston Stout of Oklahoma State University. He birdied the 72nd hole yesterday to claim the NCAA Men's Division I title. In golf, the team event is ongoing out in Southern California. Great drama there. Congratulations to Preston. And the U.S. Women's Open tees off at Riviera Country Club outside of Los Angeles on Thursday. Nelly Korda, see if she can keep the momentum going and keep on winning in the biggest event in women's golf. Okay, before we get to Fred Funk, a lot of tie in I'm wearing today as I host this. I've got my University of Maryland golf cap. I've got my Maryland golf shirt. I'm very proud Marylander, and Fred as well. The story of Fred Funk, as I said at the outset, is simply remarkable. Golf coach at University of Maryland, got on tour relatively late in his mid-30s. No one really ever thought that Fred Funk would be the player that he turned out to be, except maybe for Fred Funk. And he just scrapped and played and hit the ball down the middle time and time again, was always in a good spot, and ended up making enough putts 8 times to win on tour, with the biggest being the 2005 Players Championship. Man, we covered a lot of ground with Fred. He's a real champion on the course and off the course, as you'll hear in this interview. I've got a lot in common with Fred in that my late father, Max Elbin, was enshrined 2 years ago in the Maryland Golf Hall of Fame. Fred was just inducted into that same Hall of Fame last month and extremely deserving of that. You'll hear from Fred right after. You'll hear from our friends at William & Harry Golf and the Friars Golf Club. And remember, subscribe, like us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, wherever you enjoy your podcast. Right after these words, Fred Funk, terrific interview here on Musings on Golf. This Father's Day, give Dad something he'll carry for years to come. The William & Harry Full Grain Calfskin Leather Weekender Duffel is crafted for golf trips, weekend escapes, private club weekends, business travel, and elevated everyday carry. With timeless styling and premium craftsmanship, the supple full-grain calfskin leather is more than a travel bag. It's a statement piece for the modern gentleman. Structured, refined, and designed to travel beautifully, each weekender also includes a protective dust bag for the ultimate luxury experience. Now, for Father's Day, the Leather Weekender Duffel is available for only $385. Visit williamandharry.com today and give Dad a gift that travels as well as he does. Golf is more than your scorecard, the brand of clubs you play, or the clothes you wear. Golf is a journey where every round is a memory, filled with friends old and new. The Friars Golf Club is where those lifelong friendships are made, on the first tee, in the 19th hole, and far beyond. Exclusive trips, unforgettable rounds, and the very best people. Indeed, great courses are simply better with great company. So join the Friars today. To learn more, email us at info@thefriars.com and put the word musings in the subject line to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. So we invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience at the Friars Golf Club. Resilience, perseverance, and commitment. Those are three of the traits associated with our special guest today. Cut from his college golf team, he ultimately returned to coach at that same university. Doubted that a man of his age as a rookie on the PGA Tour could be successful. All he did was go on to capture the tour's marquee event as its oldest winner. Questioned that his lack of length off the tee would prevent him from ever winning, he led the tour in driving accuracy 8 times, en route to 8 wins, 2 President's Cup appearances, and a spot on the 2004 U.S. Ryder Cup team. He recently was honored with induction to the Maryland Golf Hall of Fame, and we've got a couple of side stories off of that. It should come as no surprise that he was a boxer for 8 years while growing up, because that fighting spirit has made him one of golf's great stories. We are delighted to welcome the pride of Tacoma Park, Maryland, Fred Funk, to Musings on Golf. Coach, how you doing?
Okay, getting old.
What are you talking about?
2 weeks from 70 right now. The body's breaking down. I've worn myself out.
I know some of the back issues have plagued you. You would still love to be out there playing full time, wouldn't you, on PGA Tour Champions?
Yeah, if I could, I would. I just can't. I had two back operations, but I've had 14 other operations that have in my career. I love anesthesia, that little nap you get when you get an operation. But yeah, I've had wrists, shoulders, back, thumb. You pick a body part other than my brain. They couldn't find my brain. Yeah.
When did you have the first surgery? When did things first start cropping up?
Wow. My back in 2017 was a biggie. I had a thumb, injured my thumb back in 2012, I think, 13. And I had to have that fused. I had a heart issue last year. I had to get stents put in, a year and a half ago. And, that was a surprise. I didn't even know that. I just had no symptoms and did the scan. And so you got a 98% blockage of your widowmaker. And I went, oh, well, let's go. So yeah, I did that. Yeah. And just, you know, not any major surgeries. I had two. Now I've had my second knee replaced just last September. The one I had my right knee replaced in 2009. But in 2008, my knee kept, I blew the cartilage out and I had all these cortisone shots and I had to keep getting it drained and in order to keep playing. And in fact, I caught Jay Haas at the end of, near the end of 2008 season for the Schwab Cup, for the Champions Tour to be the best player out there. And, I was getting it drained almost every week in the locker room or going to the doctor's office. And just prior to that, I was playing the last couple of weeks and I couldn't even walk, much less swing, but I tried and Jay passed me and I finished second. But that started it. I really had at that point, because I had that staph infection, I had six operations within a month and a half because they couldn't get rid of that staph. They had to keep going in and cleaning it out. So that knee was a big deal, but luckily they caught it. They were about 2 weeks from where they were going to probably take my leg to save my life, but I was ended up okay. And then in 2009, at the end of 2009, I had it, and I had a great year that year. I won the Senior Open, and but I had a knee replacement there at the end, and they were worried as hell because I already had this staff history, but everything worked out. So my right knee's fine. My left knee is still really achy after having it. In fact, it was a year ago at this tournament. I'm at the team event this week playing with Gene Sowers. Last year I was supposed to play with Gino and we were on a Tuesday range getting ready to go for a practice swing. And I had two drivers to hit warming up, two more balls. And I swung my driver, you know, I don't swing that hard, but completely blew the cartilage out of my left knee on that swing, went down like a knife, went in my knee. And I tried to play on it, ended up in September. I just had to get it replaced. So I got that replaced and that one's been a big battle. It still doesn't feel right, but it feels better than it did before I had to replace. But anyway, just one thing after another. It's been difficult, hard to accept because I'm a competitive guy. I've lost too much yardage and I was already, you know, pretty short, but now I average about, if I average 240, that's a good week. And we average 7,100 yards out here on the Champions Tour. So I'm hitting a lot of hybrids or can't even reach the greens on some of them. Can't reach some of the fairways sometimes where we're playing them. So I'm playing because I love the guys. I love the camaraderie we have. I love the brotherhood that we have out there. It's really unbelievable fraternity, but I don't want to give it up, but I'm going to play if I play 15 this year, that'll be a lot. And then next year I'll pick and choose a couple that I like if I'm feeling good and then I'll be done.
Far did you hit it on average during your PGA Tour days? What was the farthest you had ever hit an average off the tee?
278. Which was plenty long back then. Early 2000s when I was playing really, really good from, 2000, 2001 through 2008 or 9, after I got on the Champions Tour as well. That's when I made the Cup teams and I won the Players and I won when I was 50 at Cancun. And I kept playing really good. The U.S. Senior Open and two other majors out here, so there was a stretch there where I was playing extremely good golf, high level. My goal was always to finish in the top 30 so I could go to Atlanta and play the Schwab Cup at the end. or the FedEx Cup, whatever it was called back then. And I did that a lot. So, what I'm proud of is when you make the team, I never thought I'd make a team. First of all, anybody told me I was going to be a Ryder Cup player or a President's Cup team, but that's based on longevity and having a good, not longevity, but playing well for a long time for a 2 year period. And I played my way onto two teams and got picked on one. And, you know, that was really exciting. So I was, even though we got really killed by Langer, was the captain of the Ryder Cup team in 2004. Yeah, 2004. And Sutton was our captain. And that's the year that Hal put Tiger and Phil together. And they didn't like each other then. And I don't know why he did that. They got blasted. Phil was just changing equipment. He had no idea what he was doing at that particular week. And we never really saw him because he's out trying to figure things out. But, you know, if you're the captain, you go to Tiger. You don't even need to go to Phil. You go to Tiger and you go, Tiger, you want to play with Phil? And Phil or Tiger's going to go, no, I really don't. And then it's over. You don't force the issue. But they ended up playing 2 days in a row. And actually, I had a pretty funny story. We're going back to the hotel at the same time Tiger was going. So I get in the courtesy car with him. We got a driver. So Tiger's in the front seat. Passenger. I'm in the back with Elon, and nothing's being said. We just got killed that first day. Yeah. And actually every day, but the first day we lost the morning session. We lost the afternoon session and we're way behind. Basically the cup's already over pretty much after the first round or first day. And I can see Tiger's back of his head and I go, Tiger, how was it? He goes, he doesn't do anything. And I go, Tiger, how was it with Phil? And he just went in this tirade and just went, he was useless. He didn't help me one hole. It was unbelievable. He wasn't ready to play. He doesn't know what he's doing. He has equipment he doesn't know how to use. And I'm going, okay, easy, easy, easy. And he says, and then he ends it. He goes, and I got to play with him again tomorrow. So it was pretty funny.
I'm not sure that was Captain Sutton's finest strategic thinking there, Fred.
No, he was trying to get what he thought the people wanted to see, which they did. They would want to see those two playing together, but they really weren't getting along at that time, and they did get along later on, but it wasn't a good decision at all.
You know, we try to make these interviews as timeless as possible, but I want to be timely in this particular case. We're doing this interview on Monday, June 1st, 2026, the day after the Charles Schwab Challenge and at Colonial. And Fred, it took you into your fourth year to win on the PGA Tour. And I was thinking of you yesterday with Eric Cole, now in his fourth year on the PGA Tour. He's come so close. You came close several times. It's hard to win out there, isn't it? I mean, I felt really bad for this guy. It looked like he had the tournament won, and then what happens? But Russell Henley just has a birdie barrage. Birdies the last three holes, then birdies 18 again in the playoff. Give us a sense of the challenge, what you remember of trying to get that first win and kind of the obstacles in the way to get there.
Well, my first win was really strange because I had gotten out on tour my rookie year in 89 and I lost my card the first year and then I got it right back. After I did that, I never had to go back to Q School. But in 92, I was excited about the year and I go to the West Coast and I played terrible. I go to the Florida Swing, played terrible. Go to Hilton Head, miss the cut. I'm just not scoring. I'm not confident. I'm not doing anything really well. And I pulled out of Greensboro and I go to Houston where I stay with a family who are still stay with them when we play our senior event at the Woodlands, the Insperity. And they're the godparents of my kids. But I got through Q School there. I have a comfort level there. And I got to that tournament site and I got to my host family and I just kind of took a deep breath and said, you know, this is stupid. Let's just try to relax and play the game. And if I don't make it this year, I don't make it. I'll go do something else. And I really had that attitude. And I just said, I'm just going to go do the best I can. So I go out and I forget the order. I think I shot 68-72 or 72-68. I knew I was 4 under. I make the cut. And then I go out and shoot 62, which is still the course record at the Woodlands. And then I got the lead and now what do I do? You know, so I was paired with Fulton Alum on the last day and Fulton became my cheerleader coming in. He hit it in the water on 13, and he was rooting me in. I was nervous on the first tee. Then I got in game mode, and I was playing really solid. And then, ironically, on 13, I couldn't reach the green in two at par five. And I hit the pin with a wedge, and it almost went back into the water. And I don't even remember what I did from there. I think I made the par there. And then on 14 is a really hard par three, and I hit a four iron, and it one hopped into the pin and bounced off. And had it not hit the pin, it would have gone to the back of the green or over the green. But it dropped down about 6 feet from the hole, and I make it for birdie on a really hard hole. And that gave me a little separation. And then I hung on 18 when I almost hit it in the water on 18 because I was so nervous. Yeah. But you just never know. I actually went and played golf instead of trying so hard. And
yeah,
and it worked that week. And then what became more difficult was the one win wonder. You know, you just like, oh, yeah, that was a fluke. Which it was kind of a fluke. Where I was mentally going into that week to end up winning was a shock. And then to try to win my second one was more nervous than my first one because the first one kind of came out of nowhere.
What do you think you would tell Eric Cole about the need to hang in there? What would you say to him for a guy, again, who's lost twice in playoffs and sure as heck, Fred, looked like he had it won yesterday and just – he got beat by another guy.
Yeah, he didn't lose. He got beat. And that's a big difference from giving a tournament away to coming down the stretch and a guy birdies three holes coming in and then the playoff hole. He didn't lose the tournament, so it's not his fault. He played well. He played solid golf. Apparently, he did something early on Hogan's alley there, I guess. I don't know what he did there. But Eric is a bulldog. He's kind of like Brian Harmon. Just goes out there and does his deal. He's going to keep knocking at the door and he'll get his win and then probably go on. But it is very difficult to win out there. You've got to have a lot of good things happen. You got to get lucky here and there and just hope a guy doesn't get hot coming in if you're close. And, you know, it's a lot easier to handle when you didn't give it away and the guy came from behind and beat you. I've given a couple tournaments away that I still think about that I had and should have won, and I didn't because I just didn't perform coming down the stretch like you needed to. And then I've done others where I won and I performed really well coming down the stretch. So you just never know what's going to happen. The game is really difficult and the emotions get really high and the intensity gets really intense. And it also depends on what kind of finishing holes they are and whether they fit your eye or not, you know, what venue you're at and you know, where you're playing, how you're playing, it all makes a big deal. He's going to do well. I feel bad for him, but I don't feel sorry for him because he didn't lose the tournament. He just got beat.
Fred, I know our listeners are enjoying your terrific stories. Tell you what, let's take a short break to hear from our corporate partner at William & Harry Golf, and then we'll be right back with more of our conversation. Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com. Fred Funk joining us here on Musings on Golf. So in that rather lengthy intro, I mentioned about you as a kid being a boxer. Was that something that you wanted to do? And how did that come to be?
Well, when I was 8 years old, there was a guy down the street that moved into this house. Neighborhood kids, all my buddies down the street. We played football and basketball, did everything out in the street. And the guy came out and introduced himself to us and said, hey, you guys want to learn how to box? And I went, sure. You know, I was kind of curious. So I got in there and he showed me some of the moves and I said, I kind of like this. And he saw that I was interested And College Park Boys Club, where I lived in College Park, didn't have a boxing team, but Adelphi Boys Club did. And all the other boys clubs in PG County had them. And so I joined Adelphi boxing team, and they had a former boxer, Golden Gloves boxer. Joe Gardella was our coach. He was 49-1 when he was an amateur boxer in Golden Gloves. And he was the lightweight. So he was like a, you know, a welterweight, 140, 147. So he wasn't a big guy. And I really liked doing it. So I loved the discipline, all the training we did. We trained usually from October, end of October till April. And that did our winter months. So we were always together training. And then in April, we had a big tournament with all the boys clubs in PG County. And Sugar Ray Leonard was my age. And he started when he was about 9, the way I remember it. And, you know, when you're 8 years old, you get in the ring and you just put your head down and you just throw punches, not looking up. And then you learn how to fight. You learn how to do what you need to do. But yeah. Sugar Ray showed up, and this kid already had the boxing presence or the ring presence. And he was like, oh, my, who's this guy? So he went on to be Sugar Ray Leonard. And I just went on, and once it became age and weight and went just to weight at age 17, I said, I'm out. I'm not fighting guys that know how to kill me and want to. But then ironically, 1976, I'm 20 years old. I hadn't been in a ring in a while. And they had a guy named Terry Butner who was being coached by our coach. And he needed some guys to be his sparring partners. And I went, sure, I'll do that. So he was a welterweight, and he was trying for the Olympic team. And he ended up, I did that for a month. I'm getting in the ring, getting hammered by this guy about 5 days a week. And guys like that are just so fast. You know, Sugar Ray, his hand speed are so fast. But we had the headgear and the big gloves. It still hurts like hell. But you're in there taking the punches and trying to give him a fight. And he ended up losing to Sugar Ray in the finals of the Olympic trials for the 1976 Olympic team. And it would have been pretty cool. He just happened to pick the wrong weight class to be Sugar Ray's weight class.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he went on to be the best in that weight class and a couple others. And then another part of that story, so I don't remember what year, but I'm playing Riviera and I'm on the first tee, and it's, you know, elevated tee shot, you know, par 5, usually got to wait. I'm waiting for my tee time, about 4 minutes away. And I look over on the porch, all the people are standing there, and there's Sugar Ray Leonard on the porch. And I go, I got to go say hi to Sugar Ray. And I never met him. So I go up to Sugar Ray, says, hey, Sugar Ray, Fred Funk, how you doing? He goes, you picked the right sport. And I go, what? He says, you picked Bryce Ford. I said, you know who I am? He goes, oh, yeah, you're that little white kid from Adelphi. And I went, no kidding. I said, wow, I didn't think you ever paid. Yeah, I followed your career. You did. You had a great, you know, way to go, what you did. And I said, you know, Sugar Ray, I always tell people I wish I fought you one time to say I got my ass kicked by you. And he goes, oh, I would have kicked your ass. I go, Sugar Ray, I know you would have kicked my ass. That's not a problem. He goes, well, you picked the right sport. Have a good day. You know, I had to go now. And he goes,
yeah,
play good,
yeah,
man. And I go, okay. So it was really cool that he followed my career, because we were PG County guys. And that was a big deal.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know the inside, that's Prince George's County, where Fred is proudly from. And all those boxing days, you mentioned about the discipline. Did any of that help you as a golfer? And then at the highest level, obviously on tour, in terms of time management, disciplining yourself from the highs and lows. Did boxing play a role at all?
I think it definitely did. The work ethic I learned early. I always worked hard at anything I really took up, but I wasn't afraid of working hard with jobs. I worked at University of Maryland. I had a paper route. I was cleaning carts. I picked up range balls. I worked maintenance. I did all that and tried to play golf. And at that time, I was playing all the different sports. So, you know, early on, I was playing the boys club level, basketball and football and baseball a little bit. And, but boxing was what I really stuck with. And then I stuck with golf. So I think it was more the work ethic. I wasn't afraid of putting in the time. And I used to run a lot. We had to run when we were boxing. And then I kept running. I used to always run my early years on tour and stuff, and always tried to be in decent shape. But I was self-taught. So it was things I wish I learned early, although it worked out. But I read the book, The One Move to Better Golf. He was a former Maryland player, Carl Lorne. And he had this simple ideology about the golf swing. And that's what I adopted. And I just made my swing as efficient as I could. I never really learned how to create lag and have a lot of speed, but I was deadly accurate, and that's what paid off. And when I was playing good, I was long enough back in the day. But as I aged, I got shorter and shorter when other issues came along, and that's been a problem.
And what is it about your swing that has made you mechanically that has made you so deadly accurate? Is it just the simple nature of it that you're saying?
Yeah, for sure. Really, the swing. What I learned from the book, it was from a setup position. You get into all the normal athletic positions. You know, you like you're getting like a shortstop, a linebacker. That's your athletic position. Put a golf club in there. Try to stay centered. And his whole ideology, Carl's ideology, was to turn the trunk of the body and return the trunk of the body. So basically, my left shoulder at the top of my swing, I was trying to get it to turn and get to where my right shoulder was at the top of my swing as fast as I could, mm-hmm. and not think of my arms or hands. And when you looked at my swing on video, which I didn't look at very often, I didn't like looking at it, but it was almost the same path coming down as it was coming back or going back. So the backswing, the path was, there wasn't much that could go wrong.
Yeah,
it was down the line a long time. So I never really curved the ball a lot. My misses were pulls and pushes, not hooks and slices. So I really could work on trajectory. And the year I won the Players, we get to Monday. A lot of people don't remember we went to Monday, and I had to play 32 holes on Monday. That's how much rain we got. And the wind's blowing 30 plus miles an hour. And I had hit my second shot in the five was my first shot of my third round on that Monday. And I've flighted the ball with a five iron. And then on six, I flighted this nine iron and I told my caddy, I got it. And he goes, "Yo, what do you got?" I says, "I got control of my ball today." And he says, "What do you mean?" He says, I got trajectory. I can knock it down. I can do whatever I want. I was doing it on the range and it's working today. And then I missed one fairway in the first cut all week. And the fairway, the rough was so high from all the rain because they couldn't get the mowers out.
Yeah.
So if you were in a rough, you were dead. And it just ended up playing right into my hands on that tough conditions on Sunday where I had the trajectory control. Now I don't have that anymore. That old golf swing doesn't work because the body doesn't work the same way. But anyway, it was something I stayed with one swing thought almost my entire late in my career, for sure, from 42 to about 55. That's all. I never really changed anything.
You were self-taught again. You really had no one other than that book by Carl Loren. No one who spent any appreciable time with you, nurturing your game, helping you grow as a player.
No, not growing up. Ronnie Scales was our head pro at Maryland, and he looked at me a little bit, but I never really went to anybody. I just did my own thing. And I remember reading when I was about 14 or 15, I read Sam Snead swung a broom every day in front of a sliding glass door or a mirror. Mm. And I went, "Shit, I'm going to go try to do that." So I got a broom with, you know, half plastic and the bristles, you know, one of those. It's not the full sweepy straw broom. And I went on my back patio and I did that. I still do it. I still swing a broom, and just watching your swing, and it's kind of like self-teaching. You looking at the image at the same time, it's stretching you out. It's getting you loose. And that's kind of what I did. I actually took a broom with me everywhere in my golf travels too, and swung that thing. So I thought it was good enough for Sam Snead. It's good enough for me.
Tell me the story about, as I mentioned, you were cut from the team at the University of Maryland. You left, you came back, and then ultimately you were the coach at the main campus on College Park. How in the world did that come about, Fred?
In 75. So we had Dave Ziegler was our coach, and he came from LSU, and he was a really good recruiter. We had a good team. When I got there, we had two All-Americans on that team, and Roger Simpkins and Mike Pratt. And they were really good, and they had depth. But they had a 12-round qualifying, and I got to the 12th round, and I was easily making a team. But on the second hole, the par 3, there's a dry creek to the left there, still there, and I hit my ball way left of the green. It kicked left and went down in that creek, and it took me about six to get out of there. and I kept trying to get out, and I think I made it 10. And I finished 13th by one shot, counting that 10, and he cut me. And I went, okay, well, I'm out of there. So then I was still working newspaper route. I was dropping papers to the carriers now on the weekends, working. I left Saturday morning, Sunday morning, 1 a.m, go downtown to get the papers and drop them to the kids. And I was making about $8,000 or $9,000 a year working 2 days a week. So I was doing good. I wasn't giving up that job.
Yeah.
And I flunked out. I went to PG Community College. We had an unbelievable golf team there. We happened to get all the derelicts from all the high schools in PG County were the number one players, and they all showed up that same week. We were all flunked out. We all went to PG, and we beat Montgomery County so bad that year, and nobody could ever beat Montgomery County's actually scrimmaged Maryland at Maryland. Three of their starters and three of their second team against our six, and we destroyed them on the Maryland's team. And we went to the Nationals both years. And then I came back to Maryland, and now I was one of the best players on the team. And then I graduated. I actually did get my law enforcement degree. I was going to be a cop. And I would have been the shortest cop in history. I think I would have been too short until they started hiring women, the way I remember it. And I always tease people. I said I would have needed a snub-nosed gun in my holster because it would have hit the curb when I stepped off of it. But anyway, I went to play the Space Coast Mini Tour in Orlando, Tampa, Daytona, the I-4 corridor. And I went broke down there, came back. I'm working manpower in the beginning of 81 in the winter. I'm cleaning out a burned out warehouse in D.C. Look like a coal miner. I'm freezing. I'm miserable. And my coach got promoted to assistant AD. He said, Fred, you want to coach the team? I went, yes. Get me out of here. Yep. So I did. And that ended up really everything that followed after that was stepping stones, not looking at the time, not knowing where it was going to lead. But I got in the Mid-Atlantic section. We had a great section. Then I kept qualifying for U.S. Opens and PGAs and making cuts. And I spurred me on some more. And then my fourth Q school, I got through. And then lost my card. My fifth Q score, I got back. So it was a journey, a long journey.
How did you balance being a coach and those responsibilities with, at the same time, being a player and trying to advance your playing career?
Well, that's the interesting part, because when I got the coaching job, I had teammates were now I'm coaching guys that were my teammates for 3 years. That was impossible. Because now I'm supposed to be the guy to lay down the rules and stuff. And I was more one of them than a coach. So I just played all the qualifiers. I made them play qualifiers. And I played golf with them every day, whether we're qualifying or just playing. And they wanted to beat me. I wanted to beat them. And while I was coaching, I didn't have to work the shop as an assistant. And I didn't like teaching that much. I did teach, but I didn't do it very often. And I just hung with the team, and I kept getting a little bit better. And then I started making those cuts in the majors and saying, okay, I'm not a tour player yet, but I'm close. And I just kept working at it. And I really had a goal to just see how good I could be. And if it was good enough, great. And if it wasn't, I wanted to know I gave it everything I got, which I did. And had I not made it, I think I would have been okay with it, knowing I don't think I could have done any more to have made it if I didn't make it. And being I did make it, it was great. But, you know, it was a journey. I mean, I'm 32 years old, almost 33 when I got out there on tour. So I just wanted to keep my card one time. And then I ended up keeping it 30 years.
Yeah. And Fred, as we've talked here, I know guys that you've coached and just guys that you've worked with, a number of them been really very special in your life. And a situation happened, Fred, in 1986 regarding or involving Scooter Clark, who is an outstanding PGA of America professional now. Please recount what happened that day. And it was tied in somehow with Jack Nicklaus winning the Masters that year.
Yeah, it was the day we, and it's easy to remember that year because It was the year Nicklaus won the Masters with that response putter. It was that big thing that he had. And we had just got him in the shop, and I was working the shop that day, and he was my cart boy. And he said, "Hey, Fred, you mind me trying one of these putters?" I said, "Yeah, Scooter, you can go on out, but there's a storm out in the distance, so just beware of that." And the storm was out in the distance. It was still sunny where we were. There were some big, fluffy white clouds, and then the dark clouds were beyond them. Yeah. And he hit his first putt, and it was still sunny. And a bolt of lightning came out of that white cloud and hit him direct hit. And my bartender girl saw him first and screamed, "Go, Scooter!" And I looked out the window and I saw him on the green, and I go running out to him. I was the first one to him. And he's wearing a t-shirt, and the t-shirt was burned where his necklace was. And his leg was smoking too, where it came out or in, whichever way it came out of the ground or through the necklace down through and then through the putter and blew the green up. And he's smoking on the green and he's dead. I mean, no heartbeat. And I'm like, "Oh my God, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know CPR at that point or anything." And fortunately there was a doctor that was playing, the first hole adjacent to that putting green. And he came up and saw Scooter on the ground and saw me trying to do something. And he rushed over and he started doing CPR, and we had the ambulance come. And within 5 minutes, that storm was on top of us. So now we're doing CPR on the green, lightning hitting everywhere, vicious storm. We got his heart rate going, got him into the pro shop. Long story short, he got in the ambulance. He lost his heart rate 2 or 3 times on the way to the hospital, they said. He was in a coma when he got there. From the way I remember, he was in a coma for about 5 days, and he woke up, no mental anything. He doesn't remember even going to work that day, but remembers everything else. No issues. Completely recovered. Won the state high school championship on the University of Maryland course 2 months later, and it was a happy ending, say the least. But that was a day I'll never forget. And Scooter's turned into a very special person. He's he gives and gives and gives and gives. And any kids that he's worked in a couple of the black colleges down in the South with their golf teams. He's down in Charleston, I think now, with the women's and the men's team, from what I understand. And he's an amazing guy. So, God gave him a second chance. So that was really cool.
Fred, was that a case for you? I've never been in that situation where your reflexes just kick in of, "Oh my God, I've got to get out there and do what I can." And what was that like for you when you got out and saw him on the ground?
Well, I didn't know what to do. I mean, he was, first thing I did was just trying to figure out whether he was alive or not. And as far as what I could tell, he was not. And then when the doctor got there, he's not we got to do CPR now. And, now, I tried to help the doc what little I could. I was pretty helpless. I was just a standby at that point. But, it was a day I'll never forget. It was shocking that lightning came out of how it just came on us so fast. It wasn't 5 minutes from the time he got that putter and got out on the green and did that and had that happen. So, you just never know.
Fred, I had two friends when I worked at the PGA of America who died from lightning strikes directly. One who I was still working with at the time and one who had worked with previously. And as you said, it's true. You just don't know, right? It literally can come out of nowhere, even on with it looking like it's okay from a distance. That's why I'm always, Fred, if I see just a little inkling of something, man, I am out of there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, especially in the old days, the golf courses back then, if they had an irrigation system, it was all metal. And that that attracts lightning under the ground. And then the chemicals they use, they say, can attract lightning. So a golf course is not a good place to be when you have a lightning storm. And I did learn a lot from that. And then living in Florida, it was even more so. When I see something coming, I'm out of there pretty quick.
No question. I imagine you and Scooter stay in touch in some way, and you've kept that relationship going over the years?
Absolutely. Yeah, he's up for the job. I was just telling you earlier before he came on that his mom's not doing well, lives in DC, and he's up for the job, or has an opportunity to maybe get the head professional job at Avenel. And that'll be perfect for him. He could be with his mom and have a great job, and he would do a great job. He's a very, very special guy. So whenever I see him, it's another story where it's like you never missed a beat. You just pick up where you left off.
Fred, I just think one of your story is and what you've done in your life and your career is incredible. I want to go back to the 2005, the win at the Players at 48 years of age. When you reach that age and you're playing against a lot of younger guys. Now, as it turned out, you held off Lehman, Luke Donald, Scott Verplank. You held off three really good players at that time. Do you think at that age, at 48, hell yeah, I can still win the Players? What's the mindset at that age going against guys who are going to be younger than you or hitting it far, even farther than you?
Well, the Players, I had played good there a lot. And it's a placement golf course. It's great if you have power, but if you look at the guys that have won, it's across the board. You have bombers, you have guys like me and anything in between. No, to think that I never thought, yeah, I'm going to win the Players, but I got, here's the funny thing. So start that week, Chris DeMarco was my best buddy. We played practice rounds every week and we played on Wednesday. And I was playing the X ball, Titleist X ball. And on the third hole, he goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean?" "So you're playing the wrong ball. You can't hit this ball. Try mine." So I try his and I shot 65 that day and I beat him. One of the few times I beat him. And I go into the pro shop in the locker room. The Titleist guys are all the reps are gone. And I traded in my Titleist to the shop and I got TPC logoed Titleist, non-X ball, and teed it up the next day in the tournament. But I shot that 65, and then I think it was the second round I shot 65 again in the tournament, and now I'm in contention. But I was playing really, really good golf during that time, so I didn't think I couldn't win it. It just whether I was ever going to win it. The other part of that story is though, I'm on the seventh hole of the last round because we didn't re-tee. Because we didn't re-tee, you didn't know what group anybody was in. And I'm playing with Adam Scott and Vaughn Taylor. Adam had won the year before. And I looked up and I was about three back on the seventh hole. And I told my caddy, I said, if I make a few birdies, I can get back in this thing. And he goes, "Yeah, it'd be a nice time to start." And I ended up making a 30-footer there and like a 40-footer on eight. And I birdied 10. I made a great par on 11, birdied 12, birdied 13. And now I want to look at the leaderboard. And I saw it by accident on 14. I had a three-shot lead. I go from three down to three up. And I go, "Shit." And McKay, "What's wrong?" He says, "I saw the board. I got a three-shot lead." He goes, "You weren't supposed to look at the board." I go, "I didn't mean to look at the board." But so I ended up I three putted 14, three putted 15. They were both tough putts. I hit 16 and two with a 3-iron and had a 20-foot eagle putt, missed it. So I make birdie. I go to 17, and there's a group on the green. Well, actually, a group in the drop area. Two groups and then our group. So I'm watching everybody hit it in the water. Vaughn Taylor and Adam both hit it in the water before I got up. And the wind's howling coming in your face. And I managed to get it on the green. I was thinking of hitting a 5-iron. I ended up hitting a 7-iron. My caddy goes, "5-iron? The wind's blowing 30 miles an hour, Mark. I'll let you hit a 7." And I almost hit it in the water, but then I had to putt down that hill and I three putted 17. So now I got it. I saw Lehman was in the house. Now I know what I had to do. And I hit the best drive of my life on 18. I hit it right over the boards, let the wind blow it out there. I had a 6-iron into that back pin. I was aiming at the pin. I was aiming at the left side of the green and let the wind take it a little bit. And I pulled it off the toe and it went down in that bunker. And I knew I had to get up and down. And it was sitting on the edge of the fried egg. It came out of the egg hole and sat up on the edge of that. And if it's in that egg, we wouldn't be having this conversation. It was didn't set up, and I made a great putt to at least get it in the house. And then I had to dodge Verplank and Luke Donald coming down the stretch.
What were your nerves like over those last couple holes, knowing everything that was on the line?
Well, the way I finished, because I was giving it away with my three putt, And I was still hitting good shots. I just couldn't get it in the friggin' hole. And then I got on 18 with no wind, perfect conditions is one of the hardest tee shots in golf. And it's blowing in off the in out of the left at 30 plus miles an hour. And I hit a stinger. No, I didn't really have a stinger, but I hit a low one. It wasn't a Tiger stinger, that's for sure. And it went out there a lot further than I thought I was going to hit it, but it the wind blew it to the right, and I was in the left third of the fairway, and so I was super nervous on that tee shot, but I just swung away and I hit a really good drive. And then I knew I had to do what I had to do on the second shot, and I was going for every pin. I was crazy mm-hmm. where I hit some of my tee shots on par threes and par fours, and I win where. I don't know what, if they had proximity to the hole that week, or at least on that day, I would have had to been the guy the closest because I wasn't backing down on anything. And, I fortunately got up and down and went in an egg hole. So yes, I was nervous. The nervous I ever been is definitely that tee shot on 18.
We're down to our last couple of questions with Fred Funk, my fellow Marylander here on Musings on Golf. We've pretty much talked about golf to this point, but I know for you and your bride, Sharon, philanthropy and giving back to your communities, you lived in the Jacksonville area for a long, long time, had been very, very important to both of you. Hey, Fred, tell me a little bit about who JT Townsend is and what his foundation has meant and your involvement with it.
JT, it was actually 05, the year I won. That's why I can remember is when I met him. He was one of those tragic stories you see when I was on the road at the time, but reading about this Jacksonville high school player that got paralyzed from the neck down from a football tackle. It was actually his teammate. JT was making a tackle. He played both wide receiver and safety. So he's on the defense side. He was the best athlete in all of Jacksonville actually at the time. And his teammate came behind him and was making a tackle with him, but he speared JT in the back of the head with his helmet and crushed his spinal cord. He went down. He wasn't supposed to live that night, supposedly. And he made it through the night. And then it was sometime in July. My financial guy, Harry Pappas, his kids went to Episcopal where JT went. He said, "You want to go meet JT?" And I went, "Yeah, I'd love to go meet him." So he was at his grandma's house because they had a ramp there for his wheelchair and not his mom's house. And so he's displaced from his mom and his sisters. And I go there, and it's a day, it's mid-90s. And in that room, it was 101 in that room. There was a thermometer on the room. And one little window air conditioner couldn't keep up. And he's in a wheelchair, and I saw him. He had the biggest smile, one of the most handsome guys I've ever seen. He looked like a young Gale Sayers. Perfect hair, perfect clothes, unbelievable smile. Great attitude. I went in there to lift him up, and I walked out of there totally lifted up by this guy.
Yeah.
And I walked out, and I said, golly, I just so impressed by JT. And I went back to Sharon, and I said, man, I want to do something, but I don't know what to do. And she said, let's build him a house. And I go, what? She says, let's build him a house. Let's ask the community to take care. Let's get a fundraiser. Mm-hmm. So, man, she went off, her and Vicky Pappas and Judy Zatello, the three of them spearheaded the community to get together. I got on the news radio and I just asked us one time, we're going to ask you guys, because all the same people get asked all the time in communities to give and give and give. Sure. And I just said, we're asking you to try to give JT the best life he can. Let's build him a house. And we had a fundraiser. The tour gave up the TPC for a day. We raised $800,000 in one day. We had a builder build it at cost. I went to Tim Fincham at East Lake. We're in a locker room. My wife and the three ladies had found a lot. It was $75,000 lot. And I went up to Fincham. I said, hey, we found a lot. Can you buy it for us? So the tour buys them the lot. And we built the house for about $600 and got his family together. He had a whole section of his house where his bedroom and the shower and everything had a Hoyer lift, so it could lift him out of the wheelchair and he could take a shower. And he said that was the best thing in his life. So he ended up becoming ridiculous. He finished high school, ended up going to college. He started a foundation for not only kids, but adults as well. They're in the same situation, needing wheelchairs and things like that. And raised money for them and delivered them. He personally delivered them. And that was really cool. And then I was literally I was in Birmingham. We got a phone call in the middle of the night, and JT passed. It was just too much for his body, and he died watching a comedy show with his two sisters in the living room, and they're gut-wrenching laughing, and they both looked over JT, and he just slumped over, and I cried for about 2 weeks, but never met a guy like that guy ever. There's nobody. I'm, you know, in the world of golf and having all these years I've played and all the people I've met, from presidents to the greatest legends in sports and things like that, I never met a guy like JT. To have that kind of attitude, have everything taken away from him in high school and still want to give and give and give and give and have that attitude of, you know, it is what it is. He actually wrote a poem. I don't remember the whole poem, but he says it was basically a poem to God and just saying, God, I know I'm going to walk again, but if this part of the poem, I know I'm going to walk again, but if it's your mission and you have something else for me, then I'm okay with that. And let's just go, you know, let's go. And he had that fierce attitude, that unbelievable attitude to give, giving back. So the family's doing great. JT's a legend. Amazing guy.
Right. That is, that's an incredibly powerful story. I want to close with two things. A couple days ago when we chatted, we talked about your induction into the Maryland Golf Hall of Fame. You were in a class of nine total people. And tell a little bit about the inductees, Helen Detweiler, that story, which I think is phenomenal. And also the story about Mr. Bernie Smoot, I believe 100-year-old gentleman. Two classic stories.
Yeah, I get inducted in the State of Maryland Hall of Fame, and we're at Chevy Chase, and they're inducting nine people. Four of them were women, and they go through, and all of them, everybody had these unbelievable credentials that they've done. But Helen Detweiler, back in the 30s, she was a member at Manor Country Club at the time. Ironically, I'm sitting with a guy that, John Oley, who played for Maryland, one of my best buddies, that's from Manor Country Club, never heard of her. And so there's nothing at Manor Country Club about this lady, and he's learning about her that night. But in the 30s, she won everything. And then in World War II, she was a code breaker. And then they developed this this female, 17 women became the WASP. And what they did was, because all the men were already in World War II as pilots, they had 17 women that would fly the P-51 Mustangs and the B-17s and all the other airplanes from wherever they made them to the bases and then be shipped out overseas. And she did 750 B-17 flights, getting them from the plant to wherever base they had to take them to. Jeez. And she was one of those WASPs. And then at the end of World War II in the late 40s, her and Babe Diedrichsen, Zaharias, and Betsy Rawls, and all those greats back then started the LPGA. And she was part of that. And then she got quoted from Ben Hogan about Ben Hogan saying, "This Helen Detweiler is the best swing I've ever seen in golf and the best teacher I've ever met." Coming from Ben Hogan, that had to be ridiculous. So she had already been inducted into the LPGA Hall of Fame and the World Golf Hall of Fame. And now the last thing she gets inducted in was the State of Maryland Hall of Fame. And that's pretty amazing that nobody really knew about her that much. And then they did. So she's probably the greatest female that ever come out of in the golfing world. Oh, she also designed a golf course, and I think it's called Desert Palms in Palm Springs in the 1950s. And have a lady do that is in that era is pretty remarkable. And then a Bernie Smoot. Bernie Smoot is a veteran military guy being recognized that night for, now he's 100 years old. For the last 30 years, he has played at least 300 rounds of golf at University of Maryland Golf Course every year. So they're giving this recognition, and they give him a plaque, and he's smart as a whip and gets up there, and he wasn't really supposed to give a talk. And so he gets up there and he says, well, they already gave the accolades, and I forgot to tell you the accolades. So they're saying what Bernie Smoot did in World War II. So he was on Omaha Beach during the Normandy invasion and got wounded with shrapnel in his knee. Instead of going home, he healed up and then got stationed in Okinawa and fought in the Japanese theater, survived that, goes home. Korea starts. He goes to Korea and fights, comes back home, and then he decides later on in life, he starts taking up golf at the University of Maryland. And he talks about all that, and then he just says, I just got to take this time, being you already know what I did in the military and all that other stuff. But when I took up golf, there was this young guy, and he was just a teenager, and I never seen anybody work as hard at anything in his life as this young man, and I learned everything about golf from watching him. And his sitting in this room, his name's Fred Funk, and I go, holy smokes, I had no idea that was coming, and I had no idea it was watching me, and I just started crying at the table. I'm going, wow, you just never know who's watching you and what impact you're going to have on them. But ended up, we had a couple weeks later, we had the golf team reunion for the third time, and we had Bernie in my group that day. So Bernie played with us, and he's a great guy, unbelievable. But what he's done and the impact you might have on people that you just never know is pretty remarkable, especially in this great game of golf. It's probably the only game you can meet so many people, play golf with them.
Yeah,
it don't matter what skill level it is, get to know them, and then you kind of have an instant bond. You know, guys that you may not ever see again in your life, but then you run into them and they say, yeah, I remember, you know, I played with you in such and such pro-am and thanks for helping or whatever. I hear it every week. And the people I've met, JT Townsend for one, it's just amazing. The game of golf that you can give so much back just by going out there. And like today, I'm playing in a pro-am at 11 o'clock at the tournament here, and all this money's going to something here locally, and it's all because of the great game of golf. So it's pretty cool.
No question about it. Fred, let's close this terrific interview with the question I ask all of my guests at the end, and that is, if you could play kind of a dream round of golf with three others to round out your foursome, whether they're still with us or they've passed on, who would those three be, and where would you go tee it up?
It'd be my dad, my son, and Jack Nicklaus. And I wouldn't care where we would play, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
But Jack, he was our President's Cup captain 2 years I was on the team, and he made 1 year. I made it the other year. Just a great guy. And, you know, I met Arnold, all those guys. They're great guys. I think the game of golf just produces guys that are very humble, because you're getting beaten down all the time in the trying to play this game and excel at it.
Yeah.
And it's pretty special, but that would be a special day. It'd probably be Pebble Beach, though, if I picked a course.
Not a bad place to go. Fred Funk, this has been absolutely terrific. Get out there and play well, raise more money, team up with Gene Sowers and have a great time. Get that body, get that 240-yard drive down the middle, right?
Okay. The problem is I have about 260 left.
You got to... Fred Funk, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for your time. We wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
Wow, what a great time that was with a really quality guy in Fred Funk. Thank Fred very, very much for his time, and obviously wish him all the best next week as we begin our 2 weeks of U.S. Open preview. We're joined by Adam Schreiber, PGA of America professional and the instructor for the reigning U.S. Open champion, J.J. Spahn. Adam is a terrific golf professional, obviously a fantastic instructor. You're going to hear all about how he got to work with J.J., what he talks with and emphasizes with him, and how he feels about J.J.'s game going into the 2026 U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills. For Jenna Self, Kelly Elbin, thanking you once again and signing off on Musings on Golf.